I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about one of the most interesting and colorful characters of the 20th century in American history, Huey Long. And I'm joined for the conversation today by someone who I would say has written what many people are saying is a contrarian biography of Huey Long, taking on something of the historical consensus about who Long was and what his importance is for America. That's what we're going to be talking about today, Huey Long and American Populism, with Thomas Patterson. Tom is of the Patterson Law Firm in the great city of Chicago. He is an independent historian who has a deep interest in Huey Long and Huey Long's significance for America. This is going to be a really interesting conversation today. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let me read something from your book to start with. You say this in your work: "It's time to retire the historical caricature of Huey as a menace." Our listeners have heard of Huey Long. They're historically minded. But what do you mean by that statement?
I think if you read any popular general history of the United States, when they mention Huey Long, they say he was a dictator and a demagogue, and that he was one of the most dangerous people in the United States. And that dangerous label was put on him by Franklin Roosevelt, supposedly in a conversation with Rexford Tugwell in 1932. And that just has stuck with Huey Long throughout history, despite the great biography of Huey by T. Harry Williams in 1969 or so.
For our listeners, take us back to Huey Long. He's born in 1893. Remind us of who Huey was and sort of his early days.
Sure. Huey Long, like you said, was born in 1893. And if you think about it, that means that he was in the forefront of very interesting times in the United States: the rise of the robber barons, World War I, the Roaring Twenties, and finally the Great Depression. But he left home at age 16 without having graduated from high school, and he became a traveling salesman, and he did that for roughly 4 years, traveling from Tennessee to Texas and for a variety of different companies. And then he took 2 semesters of law school at Tulane Law School with a loan from his brother, and then he studied for the bar on his own after that and passed the bar, became a licensed lawyer at age 21. He practiced for his brother for about 3 months before that partnership blew up, and he had a little chip and whetstone practice, he said, for several years before he took on the largest bank in his hometown and defeated it in a lawsuit representing a poor widow who was whose train conductor husband had been killed. And so he ran for and won election for the Railroad Commission in 1918. That was later relabeled the Public Service Commission. And he won a landmark case against a telephone company, and he secured 80,000 Louisiana consumers a refund of their telephone rates, which made him a state hero overnight. He ran for governor in 1924 and lost, largely because the Ku Klux Klan opposed him. He won again. He ran again in 1928 and was successful. He had a very successful first year, first term in the legislature of Louisiana, but he was extremely controversial, and he got impeached in 1929 through a very colorful set of circumstances, and he barely escaped removal in 1929. He had a complete failure in the legislature in 1930, so he ran for the United States Senate to try to rehabilitate his standing there, was elected overwhelmingly. Then the legislature passed a tremendous public works program after that, and he took office as a United States senator in 1932. He advocated taxing the wealthy and reducing inequality, and he advocated public works for relief expenditures because we were in the third year of the Great Depression. But he was opposed, and he was opposed on his tax policy even by the leader of his own party in the United States Senate, Joseph Robinson from Arkansas. And so he dramatically resigned all his committee assignments under Robinson, which was unheard of at the time. And then he changed his mind and backed Franklin Delano Roosevelt to be president and supported him at the Chicago Convention that nominated him later in 1932. And he was instrumental in securing that nomination for Roosevelt. Roosevelt won election, of course, and in 1933, Huey acted to improve Roosevelt's Banking Act and other legislation. And finally, he decided to start the Share Our Wealth Societies in 1934. They spread like a virus, had 9 million members at the time he was assassinated in September of 1935. But before then, he had pushed Roosevelt to the most liberal and progressive features of the New Deal.
If you don't mind, his early days, which seemed to be important in forming him taking on powerful interests in Louisiana. Of course, Louisiana at that time is really a one-party state, a Democratic state. But it sounds like he did not necessarily easily fit in all the ways in the Democratic Party of Louisiana in the 19-teens and 1920s. Talk a little bit about his developing political thought and philosophy in the days before he becomes governor of Louisiana.
Sure. He was born in the little town of Winfield, Louisiana. And as one writer has stated, and it's been repeated many times, Winfield's soil was too poor to grow much cotton. So Winfield's primary crop was dissent. The Winfield delegate had opposed the Civil War secession, even, and refused to sign the secession resolution after
it was
passed.
Forgive my geographic ignorance. Is Winfield in the northern part of Louisiana?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Baptist country, and small farmer country. And Winfield is a small farmer parish or county in Louisiana. And they provided something like 36% of its vote for the socialist Eugene Debs in something like 1912. So it was always a hotbed of radicalism and populism and even socialism. Huey, at age 15, with another classmate, debated traveling socialist lecturers who stopped off in Winfield. And Huey continued his discussion with the socialist lecturer long after the debate, long into the night. And so Huey grew up with the understanding or a belief from his family, from the Bible, from historians that he read like John Clark Ridpath, that concentrated wealth was an evil and that there were a variety of remedies available to stop it. But I should also point out, and some people have found this interesting that I pointed out in the book, that even Theodore Roosevelt, as president of the United States in 1906, gave a speech called The Man with the Muckrake, in which he said that eventually the United States was going to have to provide a cap, a limitation on fortunes that could be transmitted from one person to another. And Woodrow Wilson then had a variety of proposals where he denounced concentrated wealth, privilege, and thought that the evil that provided that concentrated wealth was tariffs, and he opposed the tariff policy at the time. So it is absolutely true that in the small farmer town of Winfield, Louisiana, Huey grew up with a hotbed of radicalism and a distrust of the wealthy. And the plutocracy in Louisiana had strict control of that state's politics. And they did not provide much in the way of benefits to everybody else. But it's also true that in the national level, we had these features of populism through William Jennings Bryan and progressivism from Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. And so these progressive ideas were all in existence at the time that Huey came of age.
And Louisiana itself, you said it was controlled in many ways by a plutocracy. You also mentioned the fact that he was opposed by the Ku Klux Klan. Does it suggest that his progressive populism was also aligned with a pro-civil rights or at least not anti-civil rights philosophy as well?
Well, I think I would be hard-pressed to deny that Huey had standard thoughts about Black people in 1893, in 1900, and 1910. I think he became more progressive after he served in the United States Senate, and one writer who was actually a critic said that Huey lacked hatred of Black people and was the only Southern senator who did. And so I thought that was interesting. But I think the Klan's opposition to Huey was not based on the fact that Huey was in favor of civil rights. It was based on the fact that he was more of a radical economically. He wasn't the conservative America first kind of Ku Klux Klan ideology that existed at the time in Louisiana.
Uh-huh. When he runs and becomes his first public office, what kind of issues did he run on, and how did he, you know, he was famous, of course, not only populist ideas, but populist communication, populist engagement with the people of Louisiana.
Oh, there's no question that Huey was a master of rhetoric. It's hard to pinpoint exactly when he crossed the line from being just a good public speaker to a great one, but he certainly advocated populist themes in his first campaign for office in 1918. And I think it's also very interesting that even as a first-year lawyer in 1916, he led a campaign to reform the state's workers' compensation laws. And he did so using classic theories of what they now call social movement, where he framed the issue, we needed to liberalize the workers' compensation law, and he mobilized support for it. He wrote letters all over the place, wrote guest columns in newspapers and so on. And this was at a time when these communications were not particularly easy. And then, so he drafted a law to liberalize the compensation law. And he then traveled to a state with a state senator to the Louisiana legislature to present it. And they made fun of him there, you know, said, are you being paid by anyone? And he said, no. Who do you represent? Several thousand common laborers. And they said, well, if they're not paying you anything, they must have good sense. And they were, you know, of course, all the legislators there guffawed at it. And then Huey, in a dramatic fashion, stood up at the end of the meeting and denounced the whole legislature as being captive to corporate interests. And then he publicized that speech that he gave to the legislature, legislative committee all over the state. And you notice that there's an interesting duality to that. He not only advanced the cause of liberalized workers' compensation law, but in the articles that were published in many of the smaller newspapers throughout his region, he was listed as a leading lawyer or leading workers' compensation lawyer in the state. Well, of course, he was a first-year lawyer at the time.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, I remember being a first-year lawyer. Nobody cared what I had to say, and no one certainly called me a leading lawyer in my practice. I mean, so you can see that he had a great coherence between his goals of increasing his stature as a private lawyer and also advocating liberalized workers' compensation. And then I point out one last point on this is that Woodrow Wilson as governor, one of the features that made him a leading presidential candidate was the fact that he reformed New Jersey's workers' compensation law as governor. Huey did that as a private lawyer in his first year of practice. So I think that's quite remarkable. Now, then when he won the Railroad Commission, do you want me to get into that?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, because then he wins the Railroad Commission and he becomes no longer possible to simply ignore or mock. Now he is a significant public official in the state of Louisiana.
Exactly.
How does that change the trajectory of his public life?
One of the interesting things and important things to note about Huey is that he focused on what position he had and what he could accomplish in that position. But he had a bit of luck. At the time that he took office in 1918, Standard Oil Company, Texaco, and the others froze out the independent oil drillers at a Pine Island oil field near Shreveport. And, of course, all the independent oil drillers couldn't ship their oil through the pipelines because they were owned by Standard Oil and Texaco and so on. And so this was a freeze-out. But what Huey advocated at the time was that the legislature pass a law giving the Railroad Commission jurisdiction over these pipelines and make them common carriers. And it's a hard issue to grip people by the throat on today, you know, pipeline regulation, intrastate regulation of pipelines, making them common carriers. But the key thing is that these independent oil drillers were capitalists, and they were being frozen out by the big industrialized oil companies, Standard Oil and the like, and so they couldn't sell their oil. And Huey said, therefore, we have to make the pipelines common carriers so that independent oil drillers can ship their oil without kowtowing to Standard Oil. And what happened is because Standard Oil froze out all these independent oil drillers, they were able to snatch their holdings in this oil field for cheap. And then so therefore, they took over this oil field. Now, interstate pipelines were regulated by the Interstate Commerce Commission, a progressive reform from many years ago, but Louisiana had never adopted the regulation of intrastate pipelines, whereas Oklahoma had, and therefore Huey advocated for that position. He advocated in favor of the oil drillers and denounced Standard Oil and became lifelong enemies of some of the Standard Oil personnel. And then, as I mentioned, he had this telephone rate case where he opposed the telephone rate increase from a telephone company, had to fight the case all the way to the United States Supreme Court, where he was complimented by Chief Justice Taft as one of the most outstanding lawyers that had ever appeared before him. He won the case, came back, and then ordered the company to issue refunds to 80,000 Louisiana consumers.
So by this time, then, he begins to acquire the reputation of sort of on the side of the common man. On the side of the small business owner, the consumer, does he? And he's noticed by someone like Chief Justice Taft. Does he begin to acquire real prominence in Louisiana politics, or more broadly national politics, or does that not happen until he actually becomes governor?
I think he had enough prominence in the state to get elected as governor on his second try in 1928. But he had very little national prominence at the time. I think it was his election as governor, and then he hosted the National Governors Conference in 1928. He got a little bit of prominence there. And then he got prominence as governor when he raided gambling joints with the National Guard, and they burned the gambling equipment or hacked it to pieces with an axe. That even made the front page of the New York Times. So
what changed between 1924, when he ran unsuccessfully, and 1928?
I think the Ku Klux Klan had receded in importance. They had passed an anti-masking law, but delayed it so that it wouldn't go into effect until the Klansmen could transfer their memberships out of state. And I think Huey continued his publicity efforts. He had controversy over a bridge over Lake Pontchartrain, where two rival members of the elite in control of Louisiana at the time were fighting over the bridge controversy, who would have the rights to build the bridge. And he exploited that division for political notoriety. And then he also paid attention to where he was weak in this prior 1924 campaign. So he was weaker in the French parishes in southern Louisiana. And so he made sure to support the United States Senate candidacies of Broussard and Ransdell in 1924 and 1926. And so when he toured with Broussard in 1926, he received an overwhelming reception, both because they loved Broussard as a French candidate, and then Huey was backing him, and so they loved Huey besides. And then Huey took advantage of that with his flamboyant speechmaking, and he secured the organization that Broussard used in 1926 to support him in 1928.
Of course, as you said, he came out of northern Louisiana, Baptist country, as you put it. What role did the Baptist culture of that place, or his own religious opinions, or his household that he was raised in, what role did that have, if any, in his populism as it grew in the 1920s?
Well, I think that he often quoted the Bible in his speeches, and I think that was a result of his family reading the Bible at the dinner table, and church took place on Sunday and also on Wednesday nights, and so he said in his autobiography that he attended all religious functions as a matter of compulsion. He absorbed the Bible, and later his populist message, he would always buttress it by quoting Leviticus chapter 25. I think it's Acts or the Proverbs that says, "Give me neither poverty nor riches." Nehemiah, where they rebuilt the temple by having the rich people provide all the funds to rebuild it. So he used religious themes in a social justice setting later in life, but he was smart enough to realize that he could not obtain state office in Louisiana without appealing to Catholics. And many Baptists, for example, opposed the nomination or the candidacy of Al Smith to be the Democratic presidential candidate in 1928. He lost because of anti-Catholic bias, primarily from Baptists. I mean, there was a U.S. senator in Alabama that just supported Herbert Hoover instead of Al Smith before religious reasons. And there was a newspaper, the Shreveport, I think it was Caucasian or something, that opposed Huey's plan for free school books for the children and the presidency of Al Smith with equal fervor. And of course, prohibition was an issue then too. And the Baptists generally favored prohibition, whereas Catholic voters and Al Smith were against it. So Huey, conscious of the Catholic vote in South Louisiana, asked his friends, he had friends who were KKK members, but he asked his friends who were KKK members not to be asked to join the KKK. And I think he realized at a young age that he needed the Catholic vote and he couldn't engage in religious prejudice.
And where did he stand on prohibition?
I think he tried to straddle the issue.
It sounds like he might have for political reasons.
Yeah, I think I think he generally sublimated the issue. It was interesting that his theory was that the aristocratic or oligarchic elements of Louisiana would always try to provide issues to divide people. And so the KKK was to divide people. Prohibition was to divide people. He wanted to concentrate on the issues of economics and political power and giving benefits to the people. And it's interesting, too, that Huey is generally portrayed as a dictator. And one of the comments that they use to buttress that is at the 1932 convention, Roosevelt's campaign manager said, "Hey, does Louisiana use the unit rule?" And Huey said, "Well, we vote as a unit on everything," right? Which is kind of a dictatorial type thing. But on the prohibition repeal amendment, the Louisiana delegation was actually divided, 17 in favor of repeal, and three people stayed seated and didn't vote to repeal it.
Then, of course, 1928 comes, as you said, he's elected governor. And this is when he starts to acquire a reputation for being a person who wants to get things done. And his critics start saying, we see him as a dictator. What issues did he campaign on in 28? And what was his administration like?
I think the three key issues for him were he proposed free school books for Louisiana school children. And he proposed that they build modern hard surface highways instead of the gravel roads that were built previously. And he advocated that New Orleans get natural gas, which was cheaper than the artificial gas that was then sold by the company. And it was interesting that when he became governor, he concentrated on a very limited program, or at least it seems limited to me. And it was a limited program, but it affected everybody in the state. Arguably not the natural gas issue, but that was everybody in New Orleans, right? And so he had that narrow program, but far-reaching program and far-reaching benefits for the people of Louisiana. And then he also acted to get his hands on all the patronage that he could, which increased his influence in the legislature. He hired many of the legislators to work on state administrative agencies and awarded their relatives patronage and things like that. And he was full of, you know, piss and vinegar, as the old people would say. And I think he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Here was this hick from northern Louisiana telling people what they had to do and how they had to vote. He once said that the legislature is like a deck of cards and I can shuffle and deal as I please. And he did that in the service of his proposal to have natural gas for New Orleans. And so he rubbed people the wrong way, and he was a little bit sloppy with respect to state funds. And so there were some questions about that. The main problem with Huey was that he wanted to dislodge the aristocratic people who were in charge of the government from their positions, and he wanted the state to provide benefits to the common men and women of Louisiana. I mean, there were quotes from people who opposed Huey. They said things like, the worst thing that happened was universal suffrage and universal education, right? Mm. I couldn't vote for anything just because Huey proposed it. I mean, and some people, the more intelligent ones, later said, yeah, in retrospect, I can see that Huey was right about some of his ideas. And the mistake we made was opposing everything he proposed just because he was the one proposing it. You know, I resented being told I had to be with him.
Of course, the legislature at the time that you're talking about was obviously dominated by the Democrats, the Democratic Party. Where did he sit in the Democratic Party? He's obviously not in the sort of old aristocratic guard. Is he sort of, as governor, is he the farthest to the left possible among the Democrats in Louisiana? Or where does he fit in that situation in 1928 to 1932?
I think he was probably far left. But, you know, populism is a funny thing. It appeals to members of the left and the right, depending on the particular issue involved. And so I think Huey had a bit of a populist bent. So when he supported independent oil drillers, I don't know that that's a far left issue. He wasn't proposing the state take over these oil wells or drill them. He was in favor of the small capitalist.
Well, but was he attacked as a socialist or a communist?
Oh, sure. Oh, my God. They thought he could spot one opponent said he could spot Lenin and Trotsky, you know, a couple of positions. I mean, because what he was proposing was radical for Louisiana. It might not be radical as radical in retrospect, but it was considered as unbelievable at the time. How dare he oppose, how dare he want to educate the children of Louisiana? I mean, the free school books program increased school enrollment by 20%. And then he did night schools for adult illiterates and had a substantial reduction in adult illiteracy from both black people and white people.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country, and they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
So if he has a somewhat contentious relationship with elements of the legislature, not uncommon between governors and legislatures, of course.
Right.
How did he shuffle those cards? How did he get deals done? What was his style?
I think his style was to negotiate with individual legislators to find out what would influence them to support his program. And sometimes he would trade and support something that legislature wanted in exchange for their support of something he wanted. Sometimes he would provide jobs to a relative. In one case, much later, he pardoned a brother of a legislator who had been indicted for fraud of a bank. I mean, he played the patronage game the way other politicians have played the patronage game, and he did so in the service of increased benefits for the state so that he had more money and more influence to deal with at the start. And so the confluence of those two elements, the fact that you had an increasing state budget and then using the old patronage techniques gave him more power. But Louisiana governors have always had a significant amount of power. That's just an unusual feature of the state.
Of course, he was also famous and wanted to be famous for the road paving and creating yes. modern roads for Louisiana. His critics charged, as you know, that he was just doing it was a publicity stunt. There was no rationality behind paving this or not paving that road. They were done hastily. They weren't going to last. It was a waste of public money. Talk about that public works project, the road paving.
Yeah. The initial road bond plan that he had in 1928 was rather limited. I think it was like $27 or $30 million. And then he paved a kind of a patchwork system throughout the state. And his theory was that once people throughout the state recognized the value of traveling on paved roads, that they would support additional bond issues later to connect the links. And so, and that's what he did. And he said that was his plan, and no plan ever worked better. Even so, in 1930, the regular session of the legislature, they voted down his proposal for about $70 or $80 or $100 million of bonds to connect these links, even though he had the support of the business community to do that. But the old New Orleans political machine and the rest of the oligarchs were afraid of that massive debt and voted down his program. But then when he won the U.S. Senate race, people realized that they were signing their own political death warrant if they opposed his plan. And so then they supported something like an $80 million public works program. They built a new state capitol. They built, they started to build the first bridge over the lower Mississippi River. They built 2,000 to 3,000 miles of paved roads in the 1931-1932 timeframe. And while some people have criticized the quality of the roads, most people believe that, for example, his state capitol was praised even by people who disliked Huey personally. And most people, even people who disliked Huey, thought that the roads were terrific. There was one critic who said, man, after I drove through the dust of Tennessee and Mississippi and Arkansas, to drive on the Louisiana roads was a real pleasure. They are first-class roads, urgently modern, is what this critic said. And this was somebody that didn't particularly like Huey.
The coming of the New Deal, or the coming of the Great Depression, of course, and Hoover's term, did Long immediately become, how did the coming of the Great Depression affect him and his governorship and his thoughts of national public office? And did he become a ferocious critic of Herbert Hoover?
He did become a critic of Herbert Hoover. Now, remember, he was elected in 1930, and the Depression had really spread to Louisiana by that time. And the voters had to approve his road bond program by constitutional amendment. And the vote for that was overwhelming, in part because Huey advocated that these roads, building of these roads, would cushion the effect of the Great Depression in Louisiana. So in other words, he applied the modern theory of public works to alleviate a depression in Louisiana. And there was a great master's thesis that measured this effect, and that the decline of income in Louisiana was about half of what it was in many neighboring states, and they think because of this road bond program. So he didn't take, because he wanted to finish that road bond program, he didn't take office as United States Senator until early 1932 in January. And when he joined the Senate, he thought he was going to support Pat Harrison from Mississippi, or Joe Robinson of Arkansas, or John Nance Garner of Texas, or maybe even Al Smith to be the presidential nominee for the Democratic Party. And he thought that Roosevelt had lost in 1920 and therefore was washed up and shouldn't be supported. But he did support, right from the start, relief for the suffering and the starving and the homeless, $2 billion of relief. And he was favorably quoted in the New York Times as stripping off the metaphysical flesh from the bone of the issue. We had people starving and we had to offer this relief, and they supported what Huey had said in the United States Senate. But when he resigned from his committee chairmanships because of his feud with the minority leader, Joe Robinson of Arkansas, you know, he didn't really have much to do in the Senate. So he spent time fixing his road bond program, which had some problems. He fixed those. He met Al Smith and decided he wasn't going to support Al Smith. He may have met other candidates and decided he wasn't going to support them. And he was talked to by Burton Wheeler and George Norris and other progressives in the Senate, and he was persuaded to switch his mind and to support Franklin Roosevelt for president. And he did so in, I think it was May of 1932. He said George Norris had helped persuade him. And, of course, the features that he used to support Roosevelt were the exact features that he opposed his own minority leader on in the Senate. So, in a way, he had effectively leapfrogged the minority leader in the Senate to obtain what was supposed to be influence in the White House. And Roosevelt, in his acceptance speech for the nomination at the party, articulated the two bases for Huey's complaint against Joe Robinson. He said, A, we need a redistribution of the wealth, and B, he said, we need to avoid having people who are nominal Democrats. We need a real break of ideology with the Republicans in order to proceed. And so those are the two elements of Huey's quarrel in the United States Senate, and Roosevelt adopted both of them, at least in his speech.
Right? So then it would seem like he and Roosevelt would be political allies, ideologically aligned and friendly with each other. We know that that's not how the relationship turned out or developed. What happened in those early years of the Roosevelt administration with Huey Long?
Yeah, it's a very fascinating question. And most historians say, well, Huey was too unruly or ambitious or whatnot to get along with Roosevelt. I don't view it that way at all. The basis of his quarrel with Joe Robinson, the minority leader in the Senate, was ideological. He wanted to tax the wealthy and provide relief expenditures. And when Roosevelt took office in 1933, the first thing he did was propose a banking act which refused to rescue or omitted the rescue of state banks. And Huey said, wait a minute. State banks are 75% of the banks in the United States. The depositors need their money. And he advocated that we had to rescue the state banks as well as the federal banks. Roosevelt's people in the Senate initially opposed that, but when Huey helped mobilize the support for it, and they flip-flopped. Roosevelt flip-flopped and then added state banks to the bill. And so that was good. But Roosevelt also proposed, and this is usually glossed over by historians, he proposed a huge cut in government expenditures, primarily hitting veterans. I mean, and the stories that you read in the congressional record are just appalling for the devastating impact that these cuts had on veterans. Veteran hospitals were leaving. People had their benefits cut from $60 to $8 a month despite having 8 surgeries over their back. There were veteran suicides. There were veterans who went to the government offices, took off their clothes, and left in their underwear saying they couldn't afford anything anymore. There was one guy sent his false teeth into Huey in the Senate. Said, hey, with these cuts, I don't have any use for these false teeth anymore. Wow. You might as well have them. And then a month later, another veteran wrote in and said, hey, can I have those false teeth? I'll file them down and make them fit because I can't afford to get false teeth on my own. And, you know, it's a situation where, you know, you're looking at this from a distance of 90 years and you're saying, I don't know whether to laugh or cry. I mean, these people were starving it just makes no sense. But, you know, Roosevelt had advocated cutting the budget in the campaign, but he had never said he was going to cut veterans' benefits. And so Huey opposed that. And that seemed to be some kind of litmus test for Roosevelt. And Roosevelt then cut off all his patronage, even though he had supported Roosevelt before the convention and backed him in the convention and was indispensable to his nomination. Roosevelt cut off all his patronage, gave it to other people. And even then, Huey didn't oppose Roosevelt utterly until January of 1935.
Yeah, what happened then? That seems to be an important, in your book, that seems to be a very important moment in understanding the relationship between Long and FDR.
Yeah, I think it's hard to say exactly what it was that triggered the switch in Huey to go total opposition. But, I mean, he had opposed certain Roosevelt initiatives. He had opposed Roosevelt's people in the Treasury Department. He had thought that there wasn't a liberal enough administration of the Banking Act. He wanted more public works than Roosevelt was willing to support. And he wanted Roosevelt to expand the money supply, but Roosevelt manipulated the Senate to give him discretion to do so, but he had no intention of doing so and did not expand the money supply. And then Roosevelt's Treasury Department started to indict Huey's allies in Louisiana. And I think some of them came down in November of 1934. And Roosevelt then had also opposed the progressive Bronson Cutting, a Republican from New Mexico who had run for election. But Roosevelt supported his Democratic opponent, even though Cutting had supported Roosevelt. And that was largely because Cutting also opposed Roosevelt's reduction of veteran benefits. And so Huey gave this speech in January of 1934 that he entitled A Policy of Ingratitude and Death. And it
That's a strong title.
You bet it is. And he went through how Roosevelt had accepted the support from Bronson Cutting. Bronson Cutting had risked everything on supporting Roosevelt, and then Roosevelt pulled the plug and opposed cutting in the election. And then he opposed James A. Farley, who was Roosevelt's patronage master, who was involved in all these machinations, and who was an anathema to every progressive newspaper editorial writer or progressive leader in the country. And so Huey broke with Roosevelt in January 1935, and then investigated or proposed an investigation of James A. Farley in February of 1935.
So, of course, obviously FDR had lots of critics of him sure. from the left and from the right. But
yes.
it does seem like, and you make the case for this in your work, that the Huey Long somehow struck a nerve with FDR or with his administration and people in his administration. That really made FDR feel like Long had to be dealt with, or at least members of administration believe Long had to be dealt with. What was it about Long that struck such a nerve?
Well, when he finally decided to oppose Roosevelt in January 1935, he gave several radio speeches which were extremely powerful. And that caused an increase in the membership of his Share Our Wealth societies, which he had started in February of 1934. And they had actually spread quite rapidly, even in 1934, before Huey decided to actually break with Roosevelt. And then Roosevelt attacked Farley in the Senate in February of 1935. And then a former member of the Roosevelt administration, Hugh Johnson, who had been running the National Recovery Administration, attacked Huey Long in a speech in March of 1935. And Huey asked for radio time to respond to that speech and got an overwhelming response. It was a quite well-received speech at the time where he outlined his program. And then he got a crowd in Philadelphia that had filled a convention hall that Roosevelt had not even filled in 1932. And so the signs of his influence were spreading everywhere. And Roosevelt's political counselor, Lewis Howe, noted it. Farley noted it. Roosevelt commissioned a poll in April of 1935, and which found that Huey could, running on a third party ticket, tip the election to the Republicans in 1936. And Roosevelt then immediately responded by increasing the relief expenditures in those states that Huey might tip to the Republicans as a third party candidate.
Of course, amazing, you know, spectacular and tragic and terrible end to Huey Long's political career and to his life. He's assassinated in 1935. Remind us of the circumstances of the assassination and what happened.
You know, Louisiana has a history of violence. I mean, it stems from the secession and the Civil War to the Reconstruction terrorism sponsored by the Ku Klux Klan and otherwise. After the Civil War, I mean, there were pitched battles between the national government and people affiliated with what they thought should be the state government, the white planters and so forth. And that tradition continued. And there were all kinds of plots being hatched to assassinate Huey because no one thought they could beat him. He just won election after election after election. And then he abolished the poll tax even, which was going to vastly increase the number of voters in the Louisiana election from those previously too poor to vote. And I think some people thought that he was going to be absolutely unbeatable with these additional poor people being allowed to vote. There are some assassination plotters, and it's very interesting to read what they're willing to say, even at the date that they were interviewed, say in the 1960s. One assassination plotter was Dave Hayes, H-A-A-S, who said in a quote while interviewed by a historian that Huey was a dictator just like the Kennedys. And I thought that was interesting, you know, because I'm thinking of 1963 and the Dallas newspapers calling Kennedy a traitor or treasonous and so on. The hatred that Kennedy engendered, what, from civil rights legislation? I don't know what exactly it was for. In retrospect, Kennedy doesn't seem very liberal at all, does he? But at the time, you know, people just did not like being told that Huey was in charge of the politics of the state, He took over local governments that were opposed to him. He was allowed legally to do that by law, but it wasn't popular with the people who were removed. He obtained control even over school teachers in the state, which other states have had a similar situation to that, like the state of Virginia had at the time a very similar structure and control by the state over local school boards and local teachers. But it was new to Louisiana, and there were some teacher firings. And so one theory was that there was a group of five people that drew straws to see which one would assassinate Huey, and that his assassin actually drew the short straw. I don't think that happened, but that was one theory that was out there. Now, the person who did assassinate him was a brilliant ear, nose, and throat doctor. He had studied in Europe. His father-in-law was in control of the parish or county in which he sat as a judge, and they had resisted Huey's longtime efforts to dislodge them. They were still in control. But in the September legislative session, Huey had sponsored legislation that would gerrymander this judge out of his position after about a year. And so that was his father-in-law. And then one of the school principals was also related to the assassin, and she was discharged as well. And other people think that this guy, this doctor, had observed the fascists in Europe and thought that Huey was a similar type fascist, and he had to rid the world of this political danger, this political fascist, or this incipient fascist, or potential dictator. And then finally, there is a story that Huey was planning to smear this guy's wife's family as being part Black, a charge that had been made against them decades earlier. I don't think that Huey had planned to do that, because he was planning to run for president. And he knew he needed Black voters in the North. Black people had joined his Share Our Wealth clubs in the North. He had given interviews with Black newspapers. He had apologized for using the N-word slur in an African-American newspaper. I just don't think that he planned to so smear this guy, because I think it would have hurt his presidential ambitions a year later. But that was a rumor that's lasted. I mean, it's still discussed today. And it could be that someone told this guy that Huey was planning to do it, even if Huey was not planning to do it. And so we don't know whether he was aware of this, or whether he believed it, or who told him, if anyone. So there's no hard evidence to that effect. But some people believe that that was the motive for it, which is just compounds the tragedy of it, it seems to me. But anyway, Huey was conducting a special session of the legislature. He walked out of the legislative session. Carl Austin Weiss, the doctor, was hiding behind a pillar in the hallway, came out and pulled his gun and shot him. One of Huey's bodyguards and people next to him hit his arm as he shot, deflecting the shot downward. The bullet went through Huey. He was taken to the hospital, probably was a victim of medical malpractice in the hospital, and died September 10th, a couple days later.
You've obviously had a long time in putting together this very well-researched, remarkably detailed account of Huey. You've obviously had spent a long time with Huey Long, thinking about him, his life, his legacy. And maybe it's an unfair question, but what, from your study, what's the enduring impact of Huey Long?
You know, it's hard to boil down because I think there are a cluster of concepts. And some people, you know, think that because, for example, I don't think he was a demagogue, that therefore I'm trying to defend him, you know, on every issue all over the place. I'm not. I don't think there's any fault he had or any mistake he made that I've omitted from the book. I wanted to write a balanced, objective, analytical appraisal. That was my only purpose. I didn't write that conclusion sentence that you quoted until I was done researching the book. That wasn't a preconceived idea I had as I went in. In fact, some of the things that I thought he did that were probably bad, research convinced me were not bad. And yet other things that he did that other writers had kind of glossed over, I thought were, in one case, illegal. So I wanted to write a balanced appraisal. If you're going to look at what his enduring thing is, I think he deserves to be in the national conversation about inequality, because he had the only plan I'm aware of that would preserve capitalism but remedy inequality. He wanted to cap incomes and inheritances and provide a minimum income and homestead for each family. And I think that's a very interesting idea. I don't claim to be an economist, but I think it's a very interesting way to remedy the primary problems with capitalism, that is inequality in my view, and still preserve the good parts of the capitalistic system. And it's not socialism, but it's not unfettered capitalism. It's capitalism with guardrails. So I think that's one part of the conversation that he deserves to be part of. The second, if you just look at him, his life, you can see certain characteristics that he had that could be emulated by anyone, whatever their field of experience is. He disregarded ridicule, reprimands, rebukes. He refused to play it safe, and he got things done. And if you look at any business book today, you know, you'll see, you know, Jim Collins writes Good to Great, and he says, you know, have the, I think he calls it the big, hairy, audacious goal, right? That's a key for a business to be great. And Huey applied that principle in politics. Even the American Conservative reviewed my book, and of course they hated his tax. They don't want his redistributionist tax ideas, but they said Huey had big ideas. And the reviewer actually went to Huey's book that he wrote called My First Days in the White House, kind of a fantasy prediction, and said that, look at Huey's idea for healthcare. This is an idea we could get behind today. It's a big idea that we ought to get, support. So he had that kind of impact. But his personal characteristics, if you look at social movement theory, framing the issue and making sure that it's impregnable from attack from other contrary frames, then mobilizing support, not being afraid to confront your opponents, I mean, those are elements of all social movement theories, and Huey applied them in the more general context of campaigns. I mean, his confrontations weren't the same as Martin Luther King's confrontations with, you know, the sheriffs of Alabama, but they were still confrontations. And if strategic and implemented correctly, they can mobilize support for a good idea. And you could even see Truman in 1948. You know, he was down in the polls. But he called Congress into a special session, proposed a bunch of legislation, Congress voted it all down, and then he ran for election against the do-nothing Congress and won a come-from-behind election. Now, if you're a Democrat today, you're wondering, what are they proposing contrary to the Republican Party? Where's the confrontation? Where's the competing program? Where's the appeal? We know what Trump's appeal is, religious people, you know, veterans somewhat, rich people who want lower tax rates, you know, industries that want to be protected from foreign imports and so on. We know who he's appealing to and how. What's the competing program? Where is it? Who's out there today?
Well, fascinating questions, fascinating book. I want to recommend to our listeners, if you are interested in 20th century history, important characters, colorful characters, interesting characters like Huey Long, you're going to love this book. It's American Populist, Huey Long of Louisiana, by our guest today, Thomas Patterson. Tom, thanks for joining us today on The American Idea.
Thanks again for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.